The Word of God to Revelation chapter 13. It is an obvious reality that an object may be both remarkable and vile at the same time. It may be so unusual as to cause people to actually stop and study it, even though the thing itself may turn out to be rotten and vile and wicked. You see that in celebrities. Yes, I know I've mentioned them from time to time, but it's because our culture is so fixated with celebrities. Those who are famous yet filthy. And you have something like that here in Revelation 13. Something significant, yet sinful. Powerful, yet perverted. An institution that predominates and persecutes. It claims to be religious, yet hates the people of God, and uses civil power in order to ensure its survival. That, of course, brings me to our subject title, which may seem a little strange, but then I don't mind being a little strange. We're all a bit odd from time to time. But our subject title is Rome is Satan's Beast. Rome is Satan's Beast. Let's note, first of all, in the first 10 verses, Antichrist in his civil power. Here arises a beast, dreadful and terrible, with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns. And on each head is written one word, blasphemy. And this beast, you can see in verse 2, is a composite beast. It's a composite of diverse elements that make it distinctly unique. It is unlike anything that ever went before. And we also see that it is energized by Satan. The dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. These 7 heads appear to represent distinct periods according to Revelation 17 verse 10. 5 are fallen, 1 is, 1 is yet to come. If that is so, then it is the 6th that is wounded to death, yet it undergoes a remarkable transformation and renewal, so much so that it is worshipped. This horrible beast that seemed to sustain such a dreadful wound is re-energized as a consequence of a seeming renewal of itself. And having been renewed, its blasphemy breaks out with greater vigor and force. Its boasting and vociferous language against God and his people. Verses 5 and 6. And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. So it was a blasphemy against God himself, against the worship of God, and against the people of God. And that ushers in great persecution in verse 7. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them, So the objective is to stamp out the people of God entirely from within its dominion and reign. So here is this beast, this ugly empire, energized by Satan. And it has arrived at a point in time when its sole reason for existence, it seems, is to obliterate the people of God. And you will notice that those who are not believers are overcome, subjugated, and enslaved. And you have this dividing line that runs through humanity. Those whose names are written in the book of life, and the rest whose names are not written in the book of life. There's a clear division running through all humanity. And those who do not belong to God become the subjects of this evil empire. And Christ issues this cryptic warning in verses 9 and 10. If any man have an ear, let him hear. And so John is saying to the readers of this, in his own day, you need to know what this means. And of course, what was true of those who read it in the first century is also true of all who hear it and read it in subsequent centuries. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. The significance of that will draw out, I trust, in due course. But Christ is saying to the church, if the church is to survive this tyranny and persecution, you will not survive by turning off your mind, by pretending your emotions will carry you through. You will survive by understanding what is taught. Secondly, verses 11 to 17, Antichrist in his religious power. Another beast arises, and initially it seems different. This beast seems lamb-like. It appears like a lamb. But underneath we discover that the very same energy of the first beast is now transferred to the second beast. The dragon energizes the second as he energized the first. And the worship generated by the second is actually worship of the first, whose deadly wound was healed. And this second beast, in a most remarkable way, has gained all the power of the first beast. See that in verse 12. He exercises all the power of the first beast before him. So the second beast has now replaced the first beast. But unlike the first beast, the second now appears religious. But it has taken all the civil power of the first. It has taken all the power of that first beast for itself. And it has now combined both the civil and the religious in itself. And in addition, it performs wonders. Verse 13. He doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. So this second beast performs wonders and miracles. Further, it deceives people by those very miracles. Verse 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. and furthermore creates images that seem themselves to perform miracles, according to verse 15. So this is quite a remarkable institution. And what is more, like the first beast, the dominion of the second is such that everyone that is under its rule and dominion, and every facet of life, is governed by that second beast. And then in the third place, verse 18, Antichrist identified. Here we have, I suppose, the most famous number in all of history. So famous, you can actually buy history books that they tell you how this number has been used and explained down through the centuries. Some of it is more bizarre than reality, but that's the way history is. But John is saying something, and we tend to miss it because we look at the number 666. But John is saying in verse 18, here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. John is saying, if you understand verses 1 to 17, then you won't have any difficulty understanding of whom and of what I am talking about. If you know that, then you will know this. Now, all this raises naturally a very important question. Of whom and when is it speaking? I am well aware that there are a multitude of interpretations. I will ignore all of them except one, and that is that uniform understanding from the Reformation onwards. In other words, a reformed explanation. I'm not interested in all of the more bizarre ideas that have arisen since the 1850s. You can get your dispensational charts somewhere else, but that's not my forte. The uniform testimony from the Reformation up until about 1860, certainly up until 1900, is that John is describing two things. Firstly, verses 1 to 10, he is describing the existence, development, and fall of the Roman Empire. And that is because from within the text, it matches the fourth beast in Daniel 7. And the fourth beast in Daniel 7 is the Roman Empire. The 10 horns and the 10 crowns reflect the diversity of that empire while still being part of the beast. So it's a unified empire, even though it is diverse in its composition. The crowns represent all its claims of sovereign and universal dominion. And it stands in opposition to the King of Kings, who himself wears many crowns. Chapter 19, verse 12, and on his head were many crowns. And he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And again, in verse 19. So Christ as King wears many crowns. Here's a beast in opposition to the King of Kings, who also wears many crowns, who also has a name on each head. And the similarity is deliberate. Because this beast is pretending to be the only ruler in the world, the only ruler over all humanity. And the heads with blasphemies give the lie to all its claims. Because the heads with blasphemies proves it is really at war with Christ. It claims divinity, but it doesn't possess divinity. You know, it is no accident that all the Caesars of the Roman Empire all claimed divinity. You know, you can go to your history books or go down to the library and you can look at the coins that were minted. And they had the audacity to use the name God in association with themselves. They claimed to be divine, that they were the absolute rulers of the earth. It is no accident that these Caesars were worshipped. Temples were built in their honor. And it was against the law to refuse to worship Caesar. You were required by law to make an offering to Caesar. It was the one thing that was uniform in practice across the empire. The Caesar didn't care what you believed or who you worshipped. As long as you said Caesar is Lord. And when you didn't say that, the penalty was death. And that's why when Paul says that no man can say that Christ is Lord except by the Holy Spirit, to say Jesus Christ is Lord was to deny the supremacy of Caesar. And this is always the area of attack. This is the battle that is waged constantly for the hearts and minds of people. Who is your Lord? And that's why I keep saying to the adults, you know, if you say Jesus Christ is Lord, you must authenticate it for the benefit of the children and for the benefit of teenagers. There may come a time in our nation, we trust not, but there may come a time again when to say it is illegal. You think of these cases that have arisen in our country because some have refused to do a certain thing and it is deemed to be against the law. What's the issue? Who is Lord here? Is it the state or is it Christ? And that's what it always comes down to. Who rules your life? But something remarkable happens to this beast. Its head is wounded. It seemingly dies, only to reappear in a more terrible form than what happened before. So while it dies, it reappears with particular enmity towards God. So here you have that period of time in the Roman Empire. It seemed to be going in the right direction. Then it made that dramatic turn and it brought with it a dreadful period of persecution, decade after decade, until finally it collapsed itself. The second beast, the Reformed and Puritan understanding is that this is describing what came out of the old Roman Empire, known in history as the Holy Roman Empire. Out of the collapse of the Roman Empire arose a new power in the world, claiming all the power of the civil authority that was left behind. It sought to exercise both ecclesiastical and civil rule. We know from history that the Roman Empire collapsed. The capital moved from Rome to Constantinople. And into that vacuum, the Bishop of Rome claimed supremacy. and claimed all the keys that were exercised by the old Caesars. And so this new power used the civil power left behind for itself. And this religious power is called the false prophet, according to chapter 16 and verse 13. The true prophet leads people to worship God. The false prophet leads people to worship the state and the institution, that ecclesiastical body that uses the civil power for itself. This piece initially appears harmless. It initially comes like a lamb. But it is satanic. Satanic in its power. It is the greatest miracle working institution ever to appear in the world. And you will notice something interesting. His activities imitate Moses. In verse 13, he does great wonders. Also, it imitates Elijah, verse 13b, calling fire from heaven. But you will notice three specifics. The first is that the second is the successor to the first, both in authority and ministry. So when you look at this second beast, it is the direct successor of the first. And in the second place, this second beast uses the supposed resurrection that occurred in the first to show continuity with itself. Verse 12, whose deadly wound was healed. So here is the second that is using the supposed renewal of the previous kingdom. And it's using it to say, we are the inheritors of that. And in the third place, the second performs miracles as signs of its authority. Verse 13, he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Well, that leads me then to finish with some points of application. Lessons that we must actually draw from the chapter. And the first lesson surely is this, that all ecumenical relations with Romanism is sinful. If the Reformed and Puritan understanding of this chapter is right, and certainly what the chapter itself says, is that this beast is energized by Satan, and the second beast that arises from it is energized and empowered by Satan, we know from history that the Roman Empire had a successor, its offspring, in the Holy Roman Empire. But John's point is, the first and the second both serve the same master, Satan. They both serve Satan. That means the Reformation was right, doesn't it? It means the reformers were right. And that means you must stand with the Reformation. And stand with the reformers. And not apologize for the Reformation. You have no need to issue an apology for the Reformation. I mentioned last Lord's Day, a little work by J.C. Ryle, What We Owe the Reformation. If you haven't read it since last Sabbath, well, I remind you again, it's readily available. I know I got copies at some point, and have all gone. If you can't get it, I'm sure you'll get it online. Everything's online. But some of us prefer the hard copy. If you want a hard copy, it's only a few pence. But either way, read it. And then read his other little work. Why were the reformers burnt? Why were they burnt? Why were our forefathers put to death, burned at the stake? There are a number of reasons why. One was their belief, their stated, unswerving belief in the doctrines of grace. You know, when you read, as historians have recorded for us, the trials of these people, and one of the first questions they were asked was, do you believe in predestination? They said yes. They were declared heretics. Eventually, of course, they were asked other questions, such as the Lord's Supper. Do you believe in the Mass? Were they right or were they wrong? Revelation 13 says they were right to stand firm against Romanism. But then secondly, the believer's assurance. The believer's assurance is in verse 8. While it is put negatively, it is still an assurance to believers. All whose names are in the book of life will refuse all false worship. Those who are not will succumb. They will submit to false worship. So if you want to know who is written in the book of life, the book of the Lamb slain, that book written from before the foundation of the world, if you want to know them, you will find them at the means of grace. They will be identified by refusing to worship what is false. That brings me to the third point that follows on from that. Discerning the true from the false, verses 9 and 10. Here's the test and mark of faithful and true believers. Here is the test and the mark of a faithful church. John is actually quoting from the Old Testament. He's quoting Jeremiah 15:2 and 43:11. What is this test and mark? The test and mark is to discern between the false and the true. In other words, true believers are discerning, discriminating believers. And not only to discern between true and false, but he also tells us they will persevere in the true, whatever happens. Faith endures trial. Verse 7, they are persecuted. Verse 10, they are persecuted. And what is the saint's response to that persecution? He says, patience and faith. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. In other words, discernment is at the heart of this. Believers discern. They distinguish between what is true and what is false. And that's what enables them to endure trials and persecutions. Why do you think believers, communist countries and Islamic countries, were prepared to go to death? Because they could discern between an ideology that was false, communism, a religion that was false, Islam, from the true faith, from the gospel. If you cannot distinguish between the true and the false, you will never endure persecution. Because you don't know what to believe. You don't know what is right and what is wrong. For the benefit of the children, when you are in school, you learn your two times tables. You learn all other kinds of tables as well, but you learn your tables. And then you go into the classroom. Teacher points you out and says, Johnny or Sarah, whatever, recite to me your two times tables. So the youngster begins. Two noughts are nothing, two ones are two, and so on. Gets a bit harder and they get to about 11, and they might say, well, two 11s is 25, and the whole class laughs, and they say, no, that is wrong. They say the right answer is, because there's a right and a wrong. And they endure, they persevere with the right answer, and they quit on the wrong answer. They don't keep on saying, oh, no, no, 2 and 2 is 5, and 2 12s or 30 or whatever. They know it's wrong. The teacher shows them how we get to the right answer. And when they see the right answer, that fixes everything. It's the same with truth. That is why the truth is to be preached. Preached simply, plainly, so that all who hear it, they can discern the truth. You are to search the scriptures for yourselves. If these things be so, and if it is so, then you will be steadfast. Rock-like. Now, no matter what is thrown at you, you will not deny Christ. That's why all these believers in all these other lands, you know, communists sent them off to Siberia and thought that 10 years hard labor and torture and a spell of a psychiatric ward would change them and alter them. Then they would come out and they would say, Jesus Christ is Lord. Get another 10 years. Islam doesn't bother. They just kill them off. Behead them right away. That is why this shocking reading from the Quran in an Anglican church is so appalling. Because the actual reading from that Quran, that passage that was read, explicitly states that Jesus Christ is not the Son of God and is not to be worshipped. You couldn't get a clearer passage or a worse passage. So here they are in an Anglican church at Epiphany of all times of their calendar, and here you've got somebody from the Islamic community reads the Quran and says, your worship is false. Jesus is not the Son of God. You're not to worship Jesus. There's no Trinity. God has no Son. And all the liberals said, isn't that wonderful? They said, isn't that lovely? Building bridges, mending fences. It was a denial of the exclusivity of Jesus Christ. It was a denial of Shorter Catechism 21. Well, I hope the children know Shorter Catechism 21. And if you don't, as a parent, you go home and look at that. Because that's the touchstone of this issue. So you need to discern the truth. But are these discerning times? Do we meet Christians who are discerning? Here's what we meet. Ach, well, you know, see all this doctrine that divides. Can't we just share our experience? You share your story with me. I'll share my story with you. And then after we have told our stories, we will be as one. Sharing each other's stories. And yet John says, If Christians are to survive, they better be discerning. And fourthly, the great need for separation. Verses 13 through 16 are actually a reflection of Daniel chapter 11, verses 30 to 37. While blasphemy and persecution came originally from the civil power, the saints were distinctively on the outside of that civil power. But in the second beast, blasphemy and persecution are from within the religious power. And so believers are swept up in this. And here you see that blasphemy and persecution has now migrated from the civil power to the ecclesiastical power. And of course, what do you find? It is the saints who continue to be persecuted. So the civil power, the ecclesiastical power, and they've both got the same focus. How can we obliterate believers from the face of the earth? It is no accident that Luther, Calvin, and Knox, and all the others, they all came out of Roman Catholicism. They did not remain within it. And what is more, there were those in France who thought they could stay within it. They said, could we not remain papists by identification while having the doctrine of the reformers? Why would they do that? Because the civil power and the ecclesiastical power hated the Protestants. In due time, you had the St. Bartholomew Massacre. But they hated Protestants. And those who wanted an easy life said, let's pretend to be papists, but secretly we'll be Protestants. John Calvin wrote his treatise to the Nicodemites, those who thought they could be secret followers of the Reformation doctrine. Come out from among them and be ye separate. It took persecution to make them and to drive them out from Romanism. God had to persecute them in order to get them to stand firm, to be easily identified. There's a great need for separation. And let me finish finally with this. Do you have wisdom? Verse 18. Do you know, as it were, this man with the 666 as his title? Well, here's a Brackel. It is that religious institution which replaced the Roman Empire. It is that religious institution that has a history of persecuting believers, known for its inquisitions, burning of alleged heretics. It is that religious institution which deposed rulers, introduced pseudo miracles, demanded total submission. It is the Pope, he says, proven by firstly his name, secondly his seat of power, thirdly his succession and time, and fourthly his behavior. Do you have such wisdom? Do you know not only the false, but also the true? May God bless his word to our hearts.